Welcome to this celebration of the short story and those who write it. We celebrate tonight two remarkably talented writers of striking fiction who are both winners of this year's Rebecca Mitchell Taramoto Short Fiction Prize, Hibakrisht and Carrie Brown. The Rebecca Mitchell Taramoto Short Fiction Prize is supported by a generous gift from her husband, David Taramoto, and is designed as a memorial which recognizes her devotion to the art of writing fiction, expands the audience for outstanding short stories, and encourages literary excellence among writers working in that genre. The prize of $2,000 is offered every other year for the best work of short fiction published by our online journal Blackbird during that period, with a particular emphasis on work by an emerging writer or by someone whose work in the genre of short fiction deserves wider recognition. It's an appropriate memorial to Rebecca Mitchell Taramoto, a writer who published her own fiction in a number of literary journals and who was herself a winner of short fiction competitions, including several sponsored by her own Richmond Magazine here in town. Rebecca was born here in Richmond, graduated from St. Gertrude's High School and later from VCU, before heading off to earn an MA in English from the University of Michigan. We are fortunate tonight to be joined here by her brother, Jim Mitchell, as well as others among her friends and family. Each of these writers will be introduced this evening by a graduate student in our Creative Writing MFA program who has earned the honor of being named the lead associate editor for Blackbird, a position of considerable responsibility requiring all manner of talents and abilities. And one of those talents is that each of them is also a writer of outstanding short fiction. To introduce Hibakrisht, please welcome Chelsea Gillenwater.
Good evening. It is my privilege tonight to introduce Hibakrisht, our first reader and winner of this year's Rebecca Mitchell Taramoto Short Fiction Prize. Her short story, A Cocoon That Would Break, which thrilled all of us at Blackbird, is a profound lyrical exploration of families, both inherited and found, set against the backdrop of the Civil War in Beirut. The world of the story is undoubtedly grim and fraught with uncertainty, but Hibakrisht manages to infuse it all with a sincere, powerful sense of hope, as when one character says, "I hope today will be a good day in your life." The story is remarkable for its complex use of structure and voice, following the characters across multiple generations. And in all of her fiction, Hibakrisht gives us a clear-eyed, compassionate window into her characters that makes us want to stay with them for as long as possible. You can find those stories in Blackbird, The Kenyon Review, Hayden's Ferry Review, 580 Split, Mizna, and others. She is a recipient of the Jane Folkes Malone Fellowship from Indiana University and the Joanne Athanas Memorial Award in Literature from the National Society of Arts and Letters. She is a professional linguist and translator, working in Arabic and English, and she has been a successful university instructor, researcher, and speaker. I know you will all enjoy hearing her read tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, Hibakrisht.
Beirut circa the Civil War is a city bound up in patriarchy and sectarian strife, those twin cords woven with threads of honor and shame. Women bore the shame of their families at their hips, men guarded the honor of their families with guns. Rabia Alameddin wrote, "One's first response is that these Beirutis must be savagely insane to murder each other for such trivial divergences. Don't judge us too harshly. At the heart of most antagonisms are irreconcilable similarities. 100-year wars were fought over whether Jesus was human in divine form or divine in human form," from An Unnecessary Woman, 2014. What in the West would be viewed as hyperbole over minutiae is to a Beiruti nothing more than due attention given to the grand significance of words reflecting matters of the soul, of mores keeping family legacies intact. Things small as greetings and glances exchanged with men strange to the family, with people other to the family sect, are enough to bring shame to a woman unraveling her family's honor. Often nothing short of blood will wash away that shame. On a Thursday in May, a few years before the Civil War began to rustle the tiles of every building in Beirut, Leila took the tramway from Tariq Jdida to the High House of Teachers for her afternoon class. She sat with her fists pushing mounds of pleated skirt over her knees. She let quiet tears drop into the chrysanthemum that rose and bent on a flimsy stalk through her fingers. A young man sitting across from her stood, adjusting the swaying of his hips to the rattling of the tramcar beneath them, and came over to her. He stood above her, and she looked down at the teardrops that ran together from red petals to her thumbnail almost as red and sobbed less silently. "I am sorry if something bad has happened to you in your life today," he said slowly, and his shadow retreated. Leila lifted her head to see him seated like he had never moved. She held her eyes below his, looking at the shadows underneath them, because shame was a beautiful thing. They weren't like shadows at all, but like mellow light that wobbled. Surrounded except for when she was on her way to and from the university, he was the first young man to speak to her outside of her family, the first she could sit across and look at without being shut away by people who had the power to move her body and will. She was afraid. The forbidden was beautiful. His name was Ibrahim Habib, and he wrote her letters that he tucked between her fingertips on Thursdays on the tramway. He bowed, and a bit louder than he had to, told her his employer sent their regards to her esteemed father. His fingers never touched hers. They never held each other's gazes. Even though the Thursday tramcar heading to the city outskirts was seldom densely populated, a single witness was enough to tap the shame of love across the streets of Beirut in those pre-war years. So Leila allowed their eyes to meet only in crossing, like the trains that pushed past each other on the metal railways along the Mediterranean coastline, winking with their whistles. In passing this way, it was easy for her eyes to blur over his tremulous lower lip and the worn edges of his brown suit. In later years, during the Civil War, the trains would stop running and all the steel would be torn up and looted. But when Leila and Ibrahim sat across from one another in the Beirut tramway, trains were regular and familiar, and Leila thought about how they ran straight, true courses. He wrote to her of his work and his life. He was a carpenter of the kind trained to build houses, but Beirut, even in the 70s, was a conglomeration of concrete, and houses were raised to make room for apartment buildings. In those pre-war years, Ibrahim made doors and cabinets surrounded by concrete instead of hanging from rafters and feeling high with clean air. He told her that he was a laborer and not an artisan and did practical things, but Leila saw beauty in the work he described. He could take a chunk of wood so roughly hewn that its curves and lines looked humped and malformed, and with measured force he turned it into a smooth board, green with newness and with right angles immeasurably sharp. She imagined he made it look as easy as drawing a brilliant golden thread from a lump of clay. Then, folding his sleeves up, he would sand and lacquer, until each board was invincible and soft and a glowing burnished thing, until his arms stung with the rawness of chemical up to his elbows. "It is beautiful," she wrote back to him. "You have beauty, your hands do beautiful things." She wrote to him in the way of her language, in the poetic lilt of his colloquial Arabic, where lamentations were more common than questions, where hearts and livers and eyes trilled in and out of sentences, where the most prosaic sentiments were wrought with earth and sweat and blood. This was the commonest of speech, so she told him he was beautiful. She said it and she believed it, because how could she not? When he was the only young man she ever saw, the only one who dared listen and receive, who took her words into his palms on paper and gave them sound through his actual blood and flesh mouth framed with a mustache. "You're beautiful," he wrote back to her. "I would be honored to be one of the minds you teach. I wish I could go back to school, but I'm only a poor boy who works with his hands." She believed this too, because women believed the things men told them, because to hold disbelief in your heart when your hands and body were forced to comply to the whims of fathers, brothers, sheikhs, and lords was to be torn in two, and the women of Beirut in the 1970s were already breaking at the knees. On the days Ibrahim did not ride the tramway with her, Leila hoped he would show up anyway, and she held daisies and chrysanthemums and gardenias in place of his letters in case he did. A chrysanthemum was her favorite because red was so calmingly offset by a supporting green stalk, because it made her look more beautiful, more modest, and clean to the other passengers, and it helped regulate her smiles and downcast glances. But Leila could not get chrysanthemums every day because Beirut was turning to stone and she had to steal her flowers from a graveyard on the way to her tramcar stop. In the days that she couldn't, she learned to keep still and quiet by composing new letters to Ibrahim in her head. She wrote to him of her life. She was training to be a teacher and wanted to wake up every morning and press skirts and scent her collars with jasmine to make herself fresh and bright so that her face and the words of learning she spoke would be one and echo in her school children's minds. Her pen almost didn't stutter as she wrote with this much hope. She told him, too, about her secret china cabinet where she kept bits of her childhood before they could decay, china doll's arms that would otherwise be lost, spools of thread used down to the last few feet whose colors would otherwise be forgotten, progressions of crochet and needlework, small and lumpy bits of them, sprawling creations with large holes organically evolving into love-tied lace. She told Ibrahim she kept them because otherwise the way in which people learn and grow would go unmarked. She did not tell him that she kept them because they were decayed, broken, ugly things. She told him, too, why she cried as much of it as she could without needing him to turn in her mind from the only man she knew to the only man who could pick up her pieces. She needed to find him beautiful, always. "Baba thinks it's not a good thing for women to work outside the home," she wrote to him. "It is important in a matter of pride for daughters to be educated and have degrees, but to work at a place where there are many other men who have authority over me is not something he thinks even teaching the children is worth. He wants to make me into an ornate vase in a glass case," she wrote. She trembled at her own poeticism. "One that is too immaculate to touch or to be dirtied, even if it was more useful handled. But I am useful and handled at home with him and with my mother. Why does that not make me happy?" Some Thursdays on the tramway, Ibrahim would say something more after sending imaginary regards to her father and placing a new letter between her fingers. "I hope today will be a good day in your life," he would say, and she would hold the warmth of his voice in the same way you hold the steam from a teacup between your lips and your chin, with your eyes closed because you would tremble if you tried to look at it and feel it at the same time. He wrote to her of his own family. "I was only 12 when Mama died, and my sister left school to clean other people's houses. She is as beautiful as you are, but I can't make her life any good. My father does not want her to go to school, even if we could afford it, because she could never work with her diploma, and we need her hands now while she is young. Somehow it is okay if she works in other women's homes when her bosses are madames and not monsieurs. You work as hard as she," Leila wrote back, "but the difference is that you make strong and beautiful and useful things and grow while you do this, because you move from this type of wood to that one, and then boards and cabinets and doors and floors and larger and greater things. This is how people become happy. You turn your work to art that never stops going further. You do not fill your palms with grime that comes again and again in the same exact place." She did not say anything about how few in number they were, the items of wood to concrete apartments needed, how limited the designs in demand. If she dwelled on such thoughts, how could she make herself believe that Ibrahim was more than he was? 30 years after the Civil War began to rustle the tiles of every building in Beirut, Dalila sat in her flat and destroyed wedding dresses. She frayed their hems and tore them into strips, dipping them into vats of black dye. The strips turned dark as the blinds that blocked the sunlight from her veranda doors. She pinned them to the laundry line spooled taut between her windows, and they fluttered like cruel banners and sucked hope from the girls who eyed them from the street. Dalila had arms and legs as sturdy as telephone poles. Her fingers webbed and gloated through the gowns that lined up at her door, careful and clean in plastic bags. She commissioned the prostitutes of Beirut to bring her dresses to destroy and let them think what they willed of her reasons. They had nails that scarred the bags with runs like their pantyhose. This was good, the first defilement of each gown's purity. The next sped to the tune of Dalila's jaws working, cracking mastic between her teeth, clack, 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 like a freight train. She ripped, stripped, dyed, and dried, and snapped each bit of cloth taut before hanging it. Her jaw was grim enough to chase away whispers about the sort of women who hang out of windows in Beirut daylight. Early in the afternoon, 30 years after the Civil War, Dalila pinned crumbling lace to her windowsill to be borne by the breeze. She let a last length of lace entwine her fingers as she lingered a moment to watch one young prostitute who had been to deliver a new dress walk down the street. Ra'id, Dalila said over her shoulder, you might like that one. I should maybe ask her to stay for you next time. She turned away from her window to look at Ra'id and her cousin Abu Fatin and their other associates seated expansively across her living room, waiting for her to complete her daily window pilgrimage, which they did not understand beyond the way people understand the common cruelty of a bitter, loveless woman. Dalila rent the lace in her palms with one broad outward thrust of finality and let its torn flowerets rain down over her toes. She roared at the fallen lace. Why are you so angry all the time, Lila? Ra'id's legs jingled on the brims of the clay flower pot he used as a footrest. He was the only one young and slim enough to bear his weight down on their woven pottery so recklessly. I'm sorry we defile your living room with our manskin. You know we're here for you too. Far more for yourselves than for me, she said, and disappeared into her kitchen, stopping only to spit in Ra'id's general direction. She called backward with her throat voice to ask what flavors they wanted, but clasped her palms and rocked her hip while she waited for them to decide, rocked it where they could not see. Lila, Lila, she hummed to her breast. Guava and rose, if you have it, Ra'id called. 3 apples and honey, Abu Fatin added. Don't forget tea, briquettes, water, yes? Dalila snorted and crushed packets of thick, fruity tobacco into her bust in reverse order, floating guava and rose up top because green and red should always coincide. She used the efficient sweep of her wide arms to gather together clean pipes and water chambers and hookah hoses and fresh bamboo mouthpieces and turned back into the living room with loaded arms and wavering hips. She maneuvered around the legs of men on her furniture. She filled their hookahs with water and peeled oil from tobacco and arranged burning coils. She packed their pipes and passed around thick wicks that held a flame better than any lighter could. She spoiled them, but lived exorbitantly off their drug dealing, with commission for her accounting services and bookkeeping thrown into the draw. She and Abu Fatin were old, old friends who had an understanding. He outwardly ran things and told his associates that she was bitter and old and a little insane, but to be handled with respectful caution because she provided first capital from her new war money that still reeked of gasoline. Abu Fatin could never tell them that she, the woman, the angry, widowed, dress-destroying old woman, was really in charge. When his associates left, Dalila would fold herself into Abu Fatin's broad arms, and they would let the tenseness run from their limbs like water, and he would let his voice run soothing as olive oil, and he would call her by her girlhood name and touch all of her scars and say his only family was her, Dalila, and his daughter Fatin, who he was called after because he had no sons. But while Abu Fatin's associates camped in her living room, Dalila ignored them and watched the quiet luster of Ra'id's lower lip. She moved like a pilgrim around the room, replenishing drinks and relighting smokes, patient, patient to their reckless trumpeting. Sometimes they broke the flower pots she so carefully etched designs into, the same woven designs she crocheted for years before her hands broke too badly to maneuver a needle and after they healed enough to hold a knife. She could always etch more lumpy pots when they were gone and turn off her lights and open the window for half an hour longer. Lila, Lila, she said to her breast. Abu Fatin was allocating districts for distributing hashish that day. Ra'id was assigned Sabra refugee camp, and he groaned because he said the poor had talent, children, and greed of mythical repute. His wit waxed brilliant and Dalila's lungs expanded with the smoke around her. Lila, Lila. Later, she would send Ra'id something sweet and fresh with Abu Fatin. Drifting back towards her window, she felt the breadth of generosity in her breast. She let Abu Fatin and his associates use her living room as a gathering venue at will. She let them, with the fumes of dye and hashish and hookah smoke deepening the darkness of her window blinds. They didn't know it, but she let them, and she could end it any moment she wished. On a Thursday, a few years before the Civil War began, Ibrahim handed Layla a letter that had words that were different than any he had ever written before. "You are so beautiful," he wrote, as he often did. And then Leila read, "Your hair looks like clouds and coffee all at once. When you take my letters, your fingers close on the pages one at a time, tapping like raindrops or a series of musical notes down a scale. Your skin looks like it is just as soft as all of that. I would be honored to hold your hand. Will you let me?" For the rest of the week, Leila held his letter in her hand instead of holding flowers from tombstones. She held it and imagined its folded edges were as straight and perfectly angled as a sweet swelling slab of wood that shone. She imagined it was lacquered and as soft and invincible as all that. She could feel it with her fingers. It felt wonderful. She felt it with all her fingers and her lips too, because she thought she would never feel another one like it again, and she wrote back. "When I was a very little girl," she wrote, "my mother taught me to be good by beating a sense of shame into my body. With metal hangers, with belts and my underwear, she scored my skin and made it rough and ugly, then uncurled my body and lifted me to face the mirror so I would breed feelings of being ashamed of this ugly body and never desire to let anybody see it." She wrote nothing to him of her father because it was easier for even men like Ibrahim to blame women than to blame other men. She wrote nothing to him of her father and instead wrote to him of her mother. "Because," she wrote, "it was the only way Mama knew how, because there was fear when I was born, because daughters are a shame and a burden, because it is how she had been taught virtue. What is virtue? To bear pride in your skin because it has done no wrong, but I wonder how we can be proud of our skins when they do good or even great things if the shame comes first and we are so preemptively frightened. I wish I knew how it felt to think my hands were music or my hands were the rain. Sometimes I feel my body is full of toxic energy. There is lightning in my clouds of hair that seems so soft to you, and it shocks me before shocking anybody else. But sometimes when I read your words, I feel so light that I think you could pierce through me like sunlight. I feel open, transparent with you. Shame is a heavy thing. You cannot hold my hand in the tram car. You must find us a place to meet. Leila." On a Wednesday in September, a few years before the Civil War began to wrestle the tiles of every building in Beirut, Leila took the tramway from Tariq Jdide and got off her car before she reached the High House of Teachers near the outskirts of the city. She got off and waited until she saw a young man with shoes and hair so bright she could have sworn they were lacquered, and wandered down the street, 2 meters behind him, letting the tips of her shoes kiss the tip of his long shadow. He led her to a workshop unfolding from a larger warehouse like an organic growth. "I work alone today," he said to her. "Nobody will see you come or go. I'm sanding boards, boring, monotonous work back and forth." "Not boring," she said. It was the first time she could answer him with spoken words instead of a smile hidden by her collar. Leila and Ibrahim sat on a worn redwood bench with piles of perfect wood and rough wood and disintegrated wood surrounding them like a knee-high forest. Every length of red-gold board drying with solemn patience glowed harder than Leila could ever have hoped. Ibrahim traced his fingers over Leila's wrist bones and collarbone and ran them over the ends of her hair. She could smell the lacquer on them. She pulled a circle of new crochet work from her pocket and pressed it into his palms. "For you." He took it and hid it in his own pocket. Their hands danced like rain or music through the afternoon.
I thought I might correct something I forgot to do before, just tell you who I am. I'm Gregory Donovan. I'm one of 2 senior editors for Blackbird, the online journal that published these stories, and the other editor is Mary Flynn, who's here with me. I wanted to also mention that our judging of this competition every year is done with the assistance and participation of all of our interns and our graduate students who work for us as well. And the final selection is done by the senior editors. I'd like to now introduce our current lead associate editor for Blackbird, Jake Brannigan.
To paraphrase an interview Carrie Brown did for Glimmer Train on the subject of her fiction, she said, "I'm interested in goodness the way some writers are interested in evil. I'm interested in the dimensions of the struggle to be good. And I'm interested in our failures in that regard. These issues feel present to me in the most ordinary life, under the most ordinary circumstances. The challenge is to render those lives, those ordinary lives, as dramatically as I feel they are lived. That's a tall order. It's difficult to do that well. Doing that while also rendering in a piece of fiction concepts and themes of financial disparity, death, race, birth, love, and grief would be an even greater feat. And if you think it's impossible to effectively include so much substance in a short story, it's clear you haven't read Carrie Brown's Funeral, for which she is awarded a Rebecca Mitchell Terremoto Short Fiction Prize. Carrie Brown is the author of 7 novels, most recently The Stargazer's Sister. She's been awarded an NEA Fellowship and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers Award, and she's currently the Wilson Fellow at Deerfield Academy. Please join me in welcoming Carrie Brown.
Thank you all for being here tonight, all the graduate students and the family of Rebecca Terremoto, and many, many students from Hollins as well, beloved students from Hollins, and thanks also to everybody at Blackboard, Greg and Mary, and all the students who work on it. Thank you. Funeral is a story in a collection of linked stories. The protagonist of the stories is a young undocumented worker who has just graduated from high school. His name is Hector Morales, and he works at a country club in a very wealthy suburb in Connecticut. And the stories follow his relationships with the people he encounters at this country club, both the members of the club and also the people who work there. In this story, you will meet Hector. You'll also meet Raul, who is an older waiter at the country club and is Hector's friend. You will meet also Katerina, who is the evil manager of the country club. And you'll meet an elderly couple, the Fishers. There are a couple of other characters, but they'll become clear. And I'll read just the very beginning of the story and then the end. Funeral. Mr. Potter was dead, but no one would have known the occasion was a sad one by watching the people arriving at the Meadows Club for the after-funeral reception. Hector helped take people's coats as they came in out of the cold March afternoon, exclaiming about the strength of the wind. "Well, my heavens, in like a lion," said nice little Mrs. Fisher from the Historical Society, where Hector mowed the grass in the summer. Mr. Fisher helped his wife off with her coat and handed it to Hector. Mrs. Fisher was barely 5 feet tall, with white hair that stood straight up from her forehead, giving her the look of a startled bird. Relieved of her coat, she appeared as small as a child. She couldn't have weighed more than 80 pounds, Hector thought. "Nearly lost her to a big gust in the parking lot," Mr. Fisher said, winking at Hector. Everyone seemed in good spirits. Drinks in hand, the guests milled around in the great hall, smiling and laughing. Maybe no one had liked Mr. Potter much, Hector thought. Most of the women were dressed in black, but that wasn't unusual. Overall, the feeling was similar to that of every other party Hector had worked at the club. He moved through the crowd, offering plates of hors d'oeuvres, mushroom tartlets, mini quiches, coin-sized crab cakes. Tony, the chef, seemed to be making everything miniature these days. Mini cupcakes, mini club sandwiches stuck through with toothpicks, soup served in shot glasses, mini burgers. Only people who had always had enough to eat would be delighted by a burger the size of their thumbnail, Hector thought. Except for the flowers at the club's entrance, a pair of towering edifices of white lilies, the event might have been any sort of social occasion. The only difference was that though wine was served, hard liquor was not available until 5 p.m. Usually you could get a drink at the club at any time of day. It had to do with some sort of respect for the dead, Raul had explained. There was only one apparent mourner, a weepy, middle-aged woman, her hair a strange shade that was somehow both red and black. She was wearing what seemed to Hector inappropriately provocative clothing for the occasion, very high heels and a purple V-neck dress that revealed plenty of brown cleavage and a necklace of what looked like ice cubes. She circulated throughout the crowd, attempting to embrace anyone she could catch. Hector watched the various strategies people employed to avoid her. They stepped hastily behind a lamp or deliberately turned their back to her or held up their wine glasses in a cautionary gesture. Everyone seemed aware that fending her off was an unfortunate but inevitable part of such affairs. No one seemed worried about offending her. And no one seemed sad. Raoul, standing with Hector at the edge of the gathering, nodded in the direction of the woman in purple. She veered, drink in hand, toward a group of teenagers huddled together in a tight circle, four boys in identical blazers and striped ties and with braces on their teeth, and a pretty girl with long, silky blonde hair. The tight perimeter they formed seemed to Hector part protection, part plot. Raoul shook his head. Mrs. Parker. Who's she? She was his wife, daughter? Hector found it difficult to determine people's ages. Raoul said it was because he was young. Was Mrs. Parker 50, 70? Huh? No, no relation. She's a widow. I never met her husband. He died before I started work here. Raoul put a hand up on one side of his head and cracked his neck, which made a distinct popping sound. Then he did the other side. She comes and cries at these things, wants to hug and kiss everybody, has too much to drink, gets on people's nerves. Hector glanced around for Katerina. She had reprimanded Raoul about popping his neck and knuckles, which he did frequently. No touching your body in any way, she had said one night recently to the staff, whom she had assembled just before the dining room opened. I don't want to see any of you fixing your hair, wiping your nose, no adjustments of any kind. She had looked meaningfully at Raoul, who had a bad back, and relieved it sometimes by twisting his torso in one direction and then the other. Don't pick your nose, don't scratch your ass, don't rearrange your goddamn balls. For the next 6 hours, forget you have a body. It always amazed Hector how coarse Katerina could be. When she was with the members, speaking with that faint trace of an accent she affected, she was so polite and apparently sincere. After this lecture, and after Katerina had left the kitchen, Raoul had mimed taking a notebook out of his pocket and licking a pencil and making a check mark in the book. They're going to get her one day, he said quietly to Hector. One day, she's going to be cussing someone out, and a member is going to overhear her talking like that, and then he made a slashing movement across his throat. Curtains for Katerina. Hector had never met the deceased Mr. Potter. Raoul told Hector that apparently Mr. Potter had so much money that he didn't actually live in Troy anymore, but had an official residence in the Bahamas or somewhere like that in order to avoid paying U.S. taxes. This seemed to Hector kind of a shitty thing to do. If you made all your money in America, didn't you owe the country its share of your wealth? He was paying taxes, and they wouldn't even let him be a citizen. Still, even though Mr. Potter hadn't been around much in recent years, some of his offspring still lived in Troy, and Mr. Potter himself continued to exert an intimidating presence in the club, like an old warlord, the memory of whose vicious deeds made people wince. He'd won tournaments in every racket sport, tennis, paddle tennis, squash, for years running, and his name appeared again and again in gold letters on the enormous wooden club championship plaques mounted on the walls in the great hall, H.W.R. Potter IV. Sometimes he'd held a title for 6 or 7 years in a row, lost one year, and then come back, presumably fired with vengeance to claim another round of wins. You could see from the frequency with which his name appeared on the plaques that there were few people who could touch him on the court. Those who did seem to have done so once and then sunk quickly from view, as if it had taken only that one foolish move, beating Mr. Potter, to earn eternal banishment. Hector and Raoul had looked inside one of the little printed programs as they had distributed them on tables around the great hall before the event began. Henry Willard Richard Dick Potter, 1921-2015. The photograph on the cover showed a handsome man in a white shirt, sleeves rolled, in his 40s at the time, Hector guessed, smiling from the deck of a sailboat. Wavy golden brown hair, strong jaw, flashing teeth, sunlight on his face. Inside the program was a little paragraph about Mr. Potter's education and achievements. Exeter, Harvard, Fulbright Fellow at the University of Oxford, Yale University School of Law, Lieutenant Governor of Connecticut, then Governor for one term, Assistant Secretary of Commerce under President Johnson, U.S. Ambassador to Belgium and then the Netherlands, Special Envoy to the Secretary of State in International Labor Affairs, Consular for the U.S. Missions in Poland, President of the Bank of New York Mellon. The list went on. How did he have time to play tennis? Hector had wondered. Sportsman, statesman, sailor, the text read. Dick is survived by 12 loving children and 61 grandchildren. Busy Dick, Raoul had said, fussily tidying a stack of programs. Hector had laughed. Raoul had smiled, but then he had gazed tiredly around the great room, empty for the moment except for Ron Black, the bartender, stacking clean glasses behind the bar. The great hall had the air of a place waiting for something important to happen there. Blink, and suddenly the place would be full of people. Or Hector had an unwelcome vision of the room in the aftermath of an explosion, cables dangling, sparks issuing from their broken mouths, beams tilted at crazy angles, heaps of rubble, the air full of bitter smoke. It seemed like every time he looked at a newspaper, he saw pictures like that, everything covered in ash. The world was getting blown up one building at a time, and it was difficult to imagine that soon the pace of destruction would outstrip the world's ability to repair the damages. He had been only 5 years old on 9/11, and he didn't remember anything about it, but he'd seen the photos, the little flecks in the air, the jumpers. One day in the media center at his middle school, some boys had looked at photos in a magazine using the magnifying glass from the big encyclopedia on its wooden stand. Hector had looked too, because it would have seemed chicken not to, but he was sorry afterward. He had seen how one falling man, dressed in a suit, had arranged his limbs for the formal descent, arms straight at his sides, feet together. The scale of the buildings, the black marks that revealed their terrible detail only under scrutiny, had made Hector feel sick. He'd only been in New York City once. The way the buildings towered over him made him feel claustrophobic. "Old Dick must have been worried the planet was going to run out of potters," Raoul said. "What a crisis. No more potters." Hector smiled again, but Raoul's face was serious. Such bitterness was rare for Raoul. Hector knew he was just tired and worried, his wife Sarah being so sick. "He must have been a pretty good athlete," Hector said, gazing up at the plaques. "He was a pretty big a-hole," Raoul said. "Everyone was too afraid of him to beat him." He paused. "That guy could ruin someone's career, their whole life, if he felt like it. Bet he did, too." "So I guess no one's going to be upset this afternoon?" "No, more like Ding Dong the Witch is dead," Raoul said. There was no mention of a wife in the program for Mr. Potter. Had to be wives with 12 children, Hector guessed. He must have outlived them all so thoroughly that they didn't even rate a mention. H.W.R. Potter IV seemed like a guy who would outlive people. Over the course of the reception that afternoon, Raoul and Hector made their way through the crowded great hall, going back and forth to the kitchen to replenish their trays. At one point, they stopped and stood together at the side of the gathering. A burst of laughter exploded from a group that had congregated by the bar, a pack of children, girls in party dresses with wide, brightly colored sashes, boys in tiny blazers with gold buttons, ran through the crowd, shrieking. Raoul stared glumly at the gathering. "I hate these happy funeral things," he said. "They give me a bellyache." Hector watched Katerina move through the room, taking people's hands in her own, pressing her cheek to theirs. Her face was composed in an expression of compassionate attentiveness. When she reached Raoul and Hector standing there with their trays of hors d'oeuvres, she cut her eyes at them. "Circulate," she hissed. Raoul sighed and moved away. Hector knew he was thinking of Sarah. There would be no drinking and merriment at Sarah's funeral, Hector knew. There would be Raoul, holding the pew in front of him, his forehead resting on his knuckles. There would be Sarah's friends crying quietly, and the hospice people Raoul had said were like angels. "You wouldn't believe it, how nice they are," he had told Hector, "and it don't cost nothing, they just volunteer. I like to think I'm a good man, but I couldn't do that," Raoul had said. "Watching someone die, even someone you don't know, I guess they get used to it, God bless them." There would be the Catholic Mass for the dead at Sarah's funeral, Hector thought. "Requiem aeternam donais Domine. Grant them eternal rest, O Lord. Let perpetual light shine upon them." Hector had been to a funeral recently with his uncle Sandor. He had gotten him in his wheelchair at St. Elizabeth's Nursing Home, loaded him onto the van with the lift, gotten him out at the church in the rain, found the handicapped entrance, sat beside him in the pew, aware in the cool high air of the church, old air, somehow sacred air, that his uncle needed a bath. Or maybe Sandor was beyond the effects of soap and water. Maybe he just smelled like what he was, a person rotting from the inside out. Maybe you could dip him in perfume and still not get rid of that smell. The dead man had been an old friend, someone Sandor had worked with at the horse farm. Afterward, there had been a reception in the church hall, coffee served from two big urns, Lipton tea bags, store-bought cookies, a platter of cold sopapillas someone had ordered from Cafe Maya. Hector was 100% certain he would break down at Sarah's funeral. He had felt hot tears in his eyes and a constriction at the back of his throat at the funeral of Sandor's friend, the man's wife sobbing openly, comforted by a group of grown children who stood protectively around their mother, rubbing her back, the girls with ravaged faces, one man, the youngest son maybe, having difficulty controlling his wobbling mouth and chin. And Hector hadn't even known the man who'd died. But Sarah was always so kind to him, and Raoul's grief, well, Hector did not think he could stand to see that. Raoul was brave. He never complained about what was happening, about Sarah's slow dying, about the toll it was taking, watching her suffer. So a bunch of bad things happen over the course of the party, the after party at the Meadows Club. And you can imagine perhaps that the drunk woman in the purple dress is partly responsible for that. She ends up actually being knocked down by a man and falls to the floor. And Hector is conscripted to lift her and carry her into the ladies' room at the club. And various things take place there. It's an altogether upsetting afternoon for Hector. So this picks up after Candy, as it turns out the woman is named, has been removed to the ladies' room, and the man who knocked her down has stormed angrily out of the club, saying she's a menace. Hector found Katerina in the great hall, picking up the discarded programs about Mr. Potter. "Is she still in the ladies' room?" Katerina said. "Mrs. Fisher's in there with her. She's okay," Hector said. "Yeah, well, she ruined my fucking night," Katerina replied. "Katerina," Hector said, "can I leave early? There aren't many people in the dining room, and Nate and Louis are here. They got it covered." "No." Hector stared at her. "You know where Raoul is," he said. "You know what's happening. Raoul has left and gone to the hospital. He's gotten word that his wife has been taken there." "Well, the whole world can't come to a grinding halt, Hector, just because someone is sick." Hector watched Katerina move to another group of chairs and adjust the position of one with her knee. "I'm not saying the whole world," Hector said. "I'm just asking for me, for now, tonight." Katerina straightened up. "What do you think would happen if I let people off every time something just, like, came up?" Hector clenched his teeth. Katerina turned away, but he followed her again as she moved. "Please," he said. "You didn't see anyone making a big fuss today about Mr. Potter, did you?" Katerina said. "That's how to do it, Hector. That's how it's done. You just carry on." She moved away from him, bent to pick up a couple of glasses from a table. "I'm going," Hector said. "You can take it out of my pay." She stopped at that, straightened up again, and looked at him. Hector turned away from her, afraid that his face would betray him, his anger, and also his fear. He knew that the woman in the purple dress, Candy, had gone about it all wrong, whatever she was trying to get for herself this afternoon, whatever she had been trying to make happen in a group of people gathered on the occasion of someone's death. Who knew what people, even his kids, really felt about Mr. Potter's death? Whatever it was, they weren't going to show it this afternoon, that was for sure. And that scared him worse than anything, he realized. Was that what it meant to grow up and be successful and powerful and rich like all these people at the club, keeping it together all the time, laughing and drinking when someone died? So what did that say about the wife of the man who'd been Uncle Sandor's friend, crying in the church? What did it say about him, trying not to cry but feeling like he wanted to, needed to? And what did it say about Raoul? These people at the Meadows Club, they were human. They must have human feelings. "You want to say that again?" Katerina said. Hector kept walking. "No," he said, "I don't." After a minute, she called after him. "You do this again and you're fired, Hector." As he was strapping on his bicycle clips in the back hall off the kitchen, he realized that he did not know what hospital Sarah had been taken to. He was so stupid. He texted Raoul, "Where are you? What hospital?" He changed into his sneakers, put his good shoes in his backpack, hung up his waiter's jacket. Outside, a light rain had begun falling through the mist. The whole world seemed shrouded and hushed, the parking lot mostly empty. The lights from the club shone hazily. He checked his phone. Nothing. He pulled his bicycle under the eaves of the building to get out of the rain for a minute. "You okay?" he texted Raoul. After a moment, a reply came. "Beth Israel, Poughkeepsie." Hector Googled the hospital and then plugged the location into his phone. It was almost 25 miles away. And now the rain seemed to be falling harder. He put on his windbreaker. He looked out across the parking lot where everything was shining darkly as if newly washed. The mist had evaporated almost completely. The loneliness he'd felt earlier seemed now as if it threatened to drown him. Everything about the evening, people's gaiety at the reception, Raoul's departure and Sarah's illness, the crazy scene with the candy lady and the man who had knocked her down, the poem she'd recited, Out of the Swing of the Sea. That was all he remembered of it. But that was not to be his fate or Raoul's. They were in the deep water. They weren't sailing on the tops of the waves like those people at the club. He calculated he could get there despite the rain. He would do it. He pushed his bicycle out into the parking lot, his head bowed against the wind. He was halfway up the club's entrance road and standing up on the pedals, pumping to get the bike up the hill, when he saw the headlights from a car behind him illuminate the road ahead. And when the car pulled up level with him, the passenger window rolled down. It was Mrs. Fisher. "Hector," she said, "you can't ride home in this weather. It's dangerous. Andy, stop the car. Hector, stop. We'll give you a ride." Hector got into the back seat. The inside of the car smelled like dogs. Mrs. Fisher was bent over the front seat, pushing things from the back seat onto the floor, papers, an umbrella, a garden trowel. "Such a mess," she said. "I'm sorry, Hector." Mr. Fisher had waved away Hector's help and put Hector's bicycle in the back of the car. He got back into the driver's seat, pulled out a handkerchief, and wiped his face. "Where do you need to go, Hector?" he said, looking back at him through the rearview mirror. "Beth Israel," Hector said, "in Poughkeepsie. Thank you so much." The car was warm. The windows fogged up a bit. Mrs. Fisher turned around again. "Everything okay?" "It's Raoul," Hector said. "His wife. She's sick." "Oh, dear." Mrs. Fisher's face was worried. "I knew that," she said. "I hope she'll be all right." Hector couldn't see out of his window at all. Mr. Fisher drove up the remainder of the entrance lane, turned onto the main road. When Hector glanced at the rearview mirror, he saw Mr. Fisher's eyes resting on him briefly. Hector looked away. What would it have been like to grow up as the child of these people? How lucky their kids were, he thought, to have good parents, to have money. He had no information about his own father, hadn't seen his mother since he was an infant, didn't even remember her. He had lived in the U.S. practically his whole life, raised by his uncle, but neither of them were citizens. He was just a fugitive, worried all the time he'd get picked up for something. "You don't have a car?" Mr. Fisher asked after a moment. His eyes were on Hector again in the rearview mirror. Hector paused. "I like riding my bike," he said. "It's good exercise." "It certainly is," Mrs. Fisher said. "We ride out at the beach sometimes, you know, on the roads there where they're blocked off. I don't like to be in traffic anymore." Hector tried to imagine the Fishers on bicycles, Mr. Fisher as tall and upright as an old stork, Mrs. Fisher on a tiny bicycle behind him, riding in his wake, Mr. Fisher's arm out when a car approached to protect her. When he glanced back out the front windshield, he saw that Mr. Fisher's gaze was still on him in the mirror. At the hospital, Mr. Fisher parked under the emergency room bay in order to unload the bicycle out of the rain. "You'll be all right," he said. "How far to get you home?" "Oh, it's not far," Hector said, though he had calculated that the distance was about 30 miles. "Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher." He put out his hand, and Mr. Fisher took it. Hector was aware of making his grip a little softer or gentler. "I'm sure Raoul will appreciate your presence very much, Hector," Mr. Fisher said. "It's very kind of you." Mr. Fisher let go of Hector's hand and withdrew his wallet. He held out 3 20s. "Cab fare," he said, "if it's still raining later. It's dangerous to ride your bike in weather like this. You give Raoul our best. Tell him we're thinking of him." Hector looked at the money. "I'm okay, sir, really." "Take it anyway," Mr. Fisher said mildly, and he reached out and tucked the bills into Hector's shirt pocket. "You never know when it might come in handy. Might want to bet on the bobtail nag." Hector had no idea what he was talking about. He started to protest again, but Mr. Fisher waved him off and moved toward the driver's side. "Good night, Hector," he said. "You tell Raoul we will say a prayer." In the hospital, Hector found the information desk, asked for Sarah Hernandez's room. The volunteer, a white-haired man in a striped red jacket, clicked away at the computer and then looked up at Hector. "ICU," he said. "No visiting hours." Hector felt his stomach drop. "Only family allowed," the man went on. "Are you family?" Hector thought about Raoul resting his head on his hands on the roof of his car, the way he had wanted to put his arms around him. "Son," he said. "Fifth floor," the man said. "There's a buzzer. If they don't answer, it means they're busy. You can go to the glass windows in the hall and wait." In the elevator, Hector felt his stomach fall away, remembered again the feeling of being on the ferry, the way he had reckoned that the water immediately below him fed into much larger waters and then into the Atlantic Ocean, a kind of downward slipping away of the earth, the water getting deeper and deeper. At the door of the ICU, he pressed the buzzer and waited. No crackling voice greeted him. He looked at his phone. Almost 9:30. He waited a minute, but it seemed rude to ring again. Instead, he walked down the hall to where it turned a corner. A glass window about the size of a big windshield offered a view of the ICU. Nurses in scrubs moved around inside, curtains drawn around some of the bays. The room was as brightly lit as the gymnasium at his high school, Hector thought. Everywhere was machinery, things on wheels or hanging from poles, computers on rolling carts, their screens glowing. It would be noisy in there. He knew that from his experience with Uncle Sandor in the hospital. But in the hall outside the window, Hector could hear nothing. It was as if the whole world's sound had suddenly been shut off completely. He thought about Mrs. Fisher with her hearing aid, and then his eyes filled with tears. He couldn't help it, and he had to bring his arm up against his face. When he took it away, one of the curtains had been drawn aside, and Hector recognized Raoul's broad back, his white shirt coming untucked from the back of his pants. He was sitting beside a bed, his back to the window, holding Sarah's hand. She was propped up in the bed, an IV in her arm, oxygen tubes going to her nose. Her eyes were closed. Hector had never seen her without her wig or a scarf. Her head was bald. He was surprised. Her head was such a beautiful shape, he thought. He had no idea a bald head could look so beautiful. He put his hand up to the window, and as soon as his fingers brushed the cold glass, Raoul turned around as if sensing him there. Hector had expected him to be crying, but he smiled, gave Hector a thumbs up. Hector raised his eyebrows, questioning, and repeated the gesture. Really? Thumbs up? Raoul repeated the gesture. Then he shrugged, hands open, as if to say, I'm not in control of any of this. It's a miracle. It's a mystery. And then he pointed at Hector, patted his chest twice, and crossed his hands over his heart. Thank you, he mouthed. Hector didn't want to walk away. He wished he could just keep doing this with Raoul all night, trading information through the glass. But Raoul tapped his watch, made a shooing motion. Go home. We're okay for now. I'll tell her you were here. Hector put both palms against the glass, leaned forward. Go see the babies, Raoul mouthed. He made a motion like rocking an infant in his arms. What? Hector mouthed. Raoul made that gesture again, rocking a baby, and gestured upstairs with his thumb. He smiled. The nursery was on the fourth floor, and there was a glass window there too, it turned out. An Asian couple, the woman in a hospital gown with a bathrobe over it, stood before the window, the man's arm around the woman's shoulders. They were smiling and talking quietly. A nurse inside reached into one of the clear bassinets and lifted out a bundle in a white blanket, brought it near to the window and held it up. The baby wore a little striped cap, and its face was bright red, its eyes squeezed tightly shut. The woman made a sound and leaned forward, smiling, raising a finger to touch the glass. Hector gazed across the room, every bassinet filled with a bundle just like this one, anonymous cocoon shapes swaddled tight. He turned his attention back to the couple, the infant held to the window, the smiling nurse, the smiling parents. The baby's eyes were closed so tightly they were like little slits in its fat cheeks. Hector found himself smiling too. The couple glanced his way and seemed with their smiles to invite him to come admire their baby. Hector moved closer to them. The woman waved her fingers at the baby as if she hoped it would wake up and see them. Hector looked at the baby again. Not yet, he thought. Oh, not yet. Don't open your eyes yet, baby. You open your eyes and everything will start up. It's going to get really crazy. No matter what you do, it's going to get really, really crazy. Just stay like that a little longer. Stay like that. Thank you.